You're listening to the Physio Matters podcast this month in association with rehabmypatient.com, and this is session 93. Welcome back to the Physio Matters podcast. I'm still Jack Chu, and I'm still delighted to be bringing you these episodes and podcasts 93 consecutive months. Fast approaching that 100 mark, very exciting. We did 200 episodes of the Chewing It Over podcast, which we got to. So we're enjoying all these little landmark moments, and we're really enjoying making these for you. Now, for our next trick, we're doing Therapy Live Business, which is our next online event, which is for therapy business owners. It's going to be the ultimate clinic business show. And we've been often asked for content to that effect from you, especially at this time, where the private sector really is well placed to step up and assist the health of the nation, as the health systems of many countries have been under strain, of course, because of the pandemic, but also because of the opportunities at NOC for making improvements in efficiency that can appropriately professionalise the sector. And so we're going to be talking with all of our favourite speakers and partners and contributors to thinking about how we can get things together and improve therapy businesses, and to make sure that there's no competing interest between clinical excellence and, of course, then great ethical business practices. So Therapy Live Business will be on the 18th of September, which is a Saturday. And yeah, get your tickets now. Last few hundred, really. It's going to be capped. We want a captive and smaller audience than these other massive shows we've done. So we've limited it to 1,500. And so we're going to be into the last few hundred of that when this gets released. So please do sign up at therapy-live.co.uk/tickets to get your free ticket. And then, of course, if you're a Physio Matters member, you can access all the content after the fact. So please do join us for that. Many thanks to this month's sponsor, and our ongoing sponsor, rehabmypatient.com, the ultimate exercise prescription and virtual conferences software. Absolutely brilliant, and we work with no one else in that space for the reason that it is the quickest and most intuitive interface for delivering that, and they've got some exciting new modules coming up soon in S&C, as well as some of our favourite clinical thinkers bringing their exercises to bear on that platform, so do keep your eyes peeled for that. Thanks to Jennifer James for last month's episode, absolutely brilliant and impactful. It's getting the conversation going, still going on social media about obesity and MSK, a thought-provoking one with obvious social consequences, and we'll definitely be visiting that conversation with her and others on our other platforms soon. This month's episode is with Rhiannon Griffiths, who is an absolute superstar, who we have bumped into now a few times across Therapy Live events and just absolutely blown it away. And you guys have asked for more from her. So here we are, providing you with a longer form discussion about the topic of menopause and how it influences MSK and beyond. Congrats to Jim for coming up with the title Menopause for Thought, which is absolutely brilliant. Well done. We love a good pun. I'll see you at the other side of this episode for final words on menopause, and I hope you really find this as useful as we have done, and as you can see, Rhiannon's stuff is well worth paying attention to, so do check out her work on physiomatters.com and on our Therapy Live content from her other brilliant presentations giving more detail to this and how it affects various different systems. So thanks a lot, I'll see you soon. So I'm delighted to be here today with Rhiannon Griffiths, and she's quickly become our go-to person in all things menopause. I'm going to talk to her a little bit about how that's gone about, whether she knows as to how we've ended up putting her in the frame at several Therapy Live events now, and why we've roped her into a Physio Matters podcast. Her work has been hugely influential in recent times for some of the things we've done at our live events, whereby it really has lit the touch paper. It's been amazing that what we thought was potentially a bit of a niche idea to get that topic involved, and we knew we really wanted it, and some of our audience had told us that they were kind of craving better insights in that direction. We've been amazed at just how well it's gone, and part of the reason for that is the messenger as well as the message. You know, Rhiannon's been absolutely brilliant and really insightful insight, especially for clinicians wanting to apply this in an MSK context, has been brilliant. So I'm glad to get stuck into it, and certainly I've learned a lot already, and it feels that then I know how many questions I have for her, so it makes sense to record it rather than me just grilling her offline. So thank you so much for joining me today. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and then how you did end up being in the frame as our menopause go-to?
So I am based in South East Wales, and I work for the NHS. I'm a clinical specialist physio in pelvic health, and I run a small team that covers quite a large, geographically large kind of like health board. But originally I'm from West Wales, South West Wales, so nearer to, quicker to get to Ireland than it is to get to the bridge from home. So definitely missing the coastal air on a day like today where it is absolutely scorching hot. But how did I become your menopause guy? I don't know. I think is the I think I sent a tweet. I think that's how it started. Do most things start this way? I think I think I was at a pelvic health menopause conference or study day that had been organized by the Welsh Pelvic Health group, and on there was a slide about joint pain, and I went star one for my MSK colleagues, joint pain menopause, left it at that, didn't think anything of it. And then I think that got picked up by some of the MACP guys. And then I was just like, do you want to do this? And then kind of COVID kind of hit off. So I thought, that's fine. I've managed to get away with that. Not gonna have to look at that, not gonna have to go down into that. And then they hit me. And then I think it was about August last year, I got asked to do a evening talk, just a short hour or so for the MACP for the guys in Wales, but I think it got about a little bit more. And I think Jim said that he was listening to me then.
Oh, did he scout you from there? That's brilliant, because I didn't know the answer to how it happened. So that's really interesting.
I think that's where it came from. He kind of briefly mentioned, oh yeah, I was listening to you, but I was out running, or I was out doing something at the time, or I was driving, so I couldn't see anything that you were doing, but I could hear you. So I think that's where it started.
We roped you in from there. And as I've said, since then, Pelvic Health Therapy Live that we did as a specialist event, but then also the large show that we did a couple of months back now. Yeah. And it has been a phenomenal response. How is that? Why do you think it is then? And what has been the feedback that you've received from those events on this topic?
I think one of the most, when you read the comments and when you kind of like read some of the feedback, I think a lot of it is not just what we can do for our patients, but also, oh my God, I'm going to be going through this, or I'm going through this, or I'm potentially, oh, that's my sister, or that's my aunt, that's my mum. You know, I think it just has such, it's so close to home. I think it's not one of these things where you kind of read about it in a textbook and you might come across it, or you might see someone with it at some point. You're probably going to know someone who is either menopausal, postmenopause, perimenopause, or will probably go through it sometime in the future. So I think that's why it's had such good feedback and people are really interested in it, because I think it just, not only from a patient perspective, but from a personal level, and we just don't know enough about it, and we don't know that it's going on. I wasn't aware of it, like even a year 18 months ago. What I knew about menopause 18 months ago is far different compared to what I know now, off the back of looking, researching, reading around, and just becoming a bit more interested in it. And you know, it's changing my attitude a little bit as to kind of like exercise and health and diet, because I know that those changes that I make now are going to put me in a better position in, you know, potentially 20 years time.
It's fascinating, and I think, you know, it's been a real interesting learning experience for us to have witnessed this phenomena around the subject matter. But I think you're right. I think it just, because it transcends the professional and the personal, but also is of interest. And I think it also makes people, it's almost got a really nice balance of specific and general. Like, it's got public health consequences, and then it's also got really specific things with regards to how it might influence niche parts of physiology or pathology and stuff. So it's like, no, there's something for everyone. And it's been one of the reasons why it's proven itself popular. Now, before we are going to get into some of the big picture stuff and no doubt public health stuff, but I feel like if we can, we just start with defining terms a little bit. So what is the menopause, and particularly then, from a predominantly MSK audience, as to what do you feel are the key take-homes for an MSK audience to become interested in it?
So on a really basic level, menopause is when your periods stop. Okay, so there's no more periods, and that's because there are no more follicles in the ovary capable of ovulating. Okay, so that really then results in a decrease in estrogen because our follicles are where the a large percentage of our estrogen comes from. So because you no longer have that anymore, you get an increase, you get a loss of estrogen. Estrogen's everywhere. There are estrogen receptors everywhere in the body. And I think that's the key thing, is that there's no part of the body really gets away with having that lack of estrogen. But everyone's menopause journey is different and it's individual. So even though we know that the average age of menopause is 51, and that comes from, the definition is 12 months after your last menstrual period. Okay, so that's the medical definition. It's not done on tests, it's not done on hormone levels anymore. It's very much done on symptoms and when was your last period. The difficulty then with menopause is that we get this perimenopause period, which can be about 10 to 15 years before we get to that point. Right. So you're potentially looking at someone from the age of 35 who might start to see some changes and some fluctuations in their regularity of their periods and may start to get some of the symptoms. And then you've got the postmenopausal period, which is then all the time after. And we're living longer. You know, we're living a lot longer now compared to what we used to. Kind of like back at the turn of the last century, so kind of like 1900. If we got to 40, 45, 50, maybe, you're doing really good. Whereas now, average age of a woman is 83. So if you're thinking we're menopausal about 51, that's about 30 years that you're living postmenopausally with this decrease in estrogen. And then if we're adding on that perimenopause time frame as well, you're looking probably at half your lifespan that you're potentially living with this change in hormonal kind of activity that has such an impact on things.
So before we zoom in on the MSK part of it, maybe, or the things that might contribute to MSK professionals needing to be more au fait with it than they would normally be, or perhaps have been educated to in normal channels. But before we go there, then, let's maybe think about what are the classic, shall we say, because you're saying it's affecting everything, and so therefore I feel a bit guilty to try and make a zoom in too quickly, but it's kind of like what are the classic things that it influences greatly.
So kind of like symptom wise the key ones that everyone always thinks about are hot flushes and night sweats. So with hot flushes and night sweats, that's, you know, especially night sweats, that's going to affect your sleep. So then you end up with poor sleep, which then has a knock-on effect then on everything else. But you also end up with symptoms like fatigue, muscle tension, mood swings, headaches, burning in the mouth, electric shocks, memory lapses, difficulty concentrating, itchy skin, irritability, gum problems, dizzy spells, allergies, breast soreness, depression, bloating, brittle nails, osteoporosis, irregular heartbeat, vaginal dryness, anxiety, joint pain, stress incontinence, night sweats, change in libido, digestive problems, disrupted sleep, tingling extremities, irregular periods. So that is just these are the symptoms of menopause. So it's not really a one-trick pony. And anyone can have a number of those symptoms. Some might have a few, some might have all of them, some might not have any symptoms at all, and some might have all of them but only a little bit, and others might have all of them but really severely. So it is very, very individual. But I suppose that if you're thinking what then affects us the biggest, you know, it's weird.
Is there a system? System almost? You know, like you say, I can't help but use it as an analogy because we're still in amongst it with the pandemic, aren't we? But this COVID affects many systems, but the respiratory system is obviously the sort of centre of that bullseye. Is it a bit like that, where you've got more or less?
It's very individual, because I think it's more kind of like that long term kind of like effects of it. So the cardiovascular risks of menopause, or kind of the kind of like those who have dementia as well, because estrogen is very, very predominant in the brain. So women are twice more likely to get dementia and at an earlier age compared to men. Women as well, you know, cardiovascular health problems are one of the biggest killers for women, which is not what we necessarily think. We always think of the cancers, and we always think of those, and specifically in women, breast cancer, but actually it's more those cardiovascular kind of like risks. And then you've got the osteoporosis. Like one in two women are going to have osteoporotic or osteopenic or kind of like bone density changes, which increases your risk of falls, which then, you know, those total hip replacements and those falls and, you know, the ability to recover and then be independent after that is just kind of even more long-standing. So like I suppose it's those phase, like the majority of people are gonna get the hot sweats and the hot flushes and the night sweats. That's predominantly what most people think about. But is that because that's what we know about it, rather than actually not really understand, you know, if we were to question everyone about all the symptoms of menopause, would they likely to say that actually there's some other symptoms that are more predominant? It's just because we're very aware of the hot flushes and the night sweats that that's where we hone in on.
So it's like, you know, that's the thing, is it's the tip of the iceberg, or the stereotypical symptoms that people might know of. And also there's something that's, you know, sort of dismissive as well, that can occur, whereby it's like, oh, that must be a mildly annoying thing. And that's one of the things that means that it gets diminished. But even from you just saying about the second order effects of the sleep disruption and the like, and also that even if it was just social anxiety rather than, of course, it being something that physiologically is going to be predisposing people to anxiety, that's still, even if that was the whole iceberg, then it's still something that you shouldn't be undermined. What is the reason as to why? Like, is that just a big alteration in physiology and hormone profile, and it's varying so significantly that the body's not homeostatically as capable? Like, why is it that those things happen?
Yeah, I think that's it. It's just the body's just going through so much change. I think the majority of menopausal symptoms, perimenopausal symptoms, tend to die down postmenopausally as our bodies start to adjust to the new regulation of hormones. Right. So there is definitely kind of like a school of thought that it's definitely more this actually up and down, you know, especially perimenopausal, that we get this influx of estrogen when we might kind of like ovulate, and then that nothing happens then for a couple of months, and then we get this massive increase again then when we might ovulate. You know, it depends, you know, if people are really, really irregular with their periods, and you're going to get these massive peaks and troughs of estrogen, which is going to then have a knock on it, you know, effect on, you know, do you know what's going on? You know, it's hard enough knowing when things are coming on a monthly basis, let alone if they're going away on holiday for 3 months and then might pop up for 2 days and then disappear again for 6 months and then pop up, and then you think you're nearly there, you think you're nearly at your 12 months, and then it comes knocking at the door again. So it's just a constant wave. So emotionally, that must be really exhausting. You know, I'm coming from this from before, so I don't know, you know, I've got all of this to look forward to potentially, but I think knowing that it's going to be variable and it's going to be up and down and they are going to be changes makes me understand, okay, what potentially might be happening. Whereas if people haven't got a clue and they're just not understanding why these things are happening, because we've never been taught about it, and you're kind of like 40 and like, well, I'm not menopausal because I'm not 50. Why is all this happening to me? And that can be quite stressful. And then, you know, with stress becomes increasing cortisol, which then increases to increased weight, poor sleep, lack of libido, and then ability to cope with more stuff, which then probably aggravates some more of the symptoms. And then just hormonally, you're just a little bit more all over the place.
Definitely. I mean, when it comes to the specifics on MSK, then there are so many factors that you're describing that you can so imagine that a contemporary clinician should be weaving into their clinical reasoning as contributing factors to various parts. They should influence your assessment. You can comprehend how they would affect any given person's life for it to be playing a part in any symptom presentation. But then there's also the more overt things whereby it would
the classic one would be, does and we know this, never mind menopausally, it's like, does the monthly cycle have any an effect in some women with regards to pain sensitivity or things like that, and the, you know, you've mentioned, say, bone density. So where do you feel that the biggest lessons that MSK clinicians need to start acknowledging and understanding menopause to be playing a significant part?
I think it's probably around kind of like the tendon and muscular kind of like aspects, right, of how estrogen or a lack of estrogen kind of like affects it. And I think, and this has probably been more eye-opening to me as I've been reading and looking into things, is that actually I didn't realize, I mean, estrogen is massively important in reducing inflammation. So if you're getting that decrease in estrogen, your ability to cope with inflammation kind of like goes, so you're more likely, I think more women are likely to have like a tendinopathy type thing, so it's going to be more irritable. And from a tendon-specific point of view, we get less collagen synthesis, an increase in kind of like the breakdown of the fibres. Takes longer to recover, more inflammation in there. And we also get a bit of extra stiffness because we haven't got, so estrogen has plays a bit in terms of having that elasticity. So you mentioned it in terms of kind of like on a monthly cycle that an increase in estrogen may kind of have a role to play in increased laxity in the joint. But when postmenopausal, when we haven't got that, then actually is the joint stiffer, is the tendon stiffer. So then with that increase in stiffness, we get a decrease in that tissue's ability to kind of like transmit that energy. So what we expect that tendon to be able to do. So actually there's an increased risk of failure. So we're more likely to get tendinopathy, like ruptures and things like that, more likely to happen in those things. And then, you know, okay, you then end up with an injury, but then because you haven't got the benefits of that estrogen, it takes longer to heal. It's not healing in the same way. It can't cope with the load that we normally would do. So it may be kind of like in rehab that we just have to think, okay, this person's not fitting my normal rehab. I know we're all very generally, we're individual and holistic to a patient, but we've got a general idea of how a tendon would normally heal and what kind of...
Everyone's got their, everyone still has their favourite exercise and favourite dosage, don't they?
Yeah, and you know, you can generally go that actually the majority of the time it's gonna work.
Yeah.
But is it in those small kind of percentage, and is it in those women where it's not working, it's not quite fitting, it's not doing the same as what it normally would do? Is it that actually we need to give it more rest, we need to give it more time to recover, because actually that whole healing process takes longer. So that needs to potentially be kind of like a consideration then from a healing and a rehab kind of point of view, from a tendinopathy point of view.
So it should be influencing your time frames and your rehabilitation pace in many ways, as well as then, and this is the hard thing, because of course, you know, by applying those individual principles you've just described, then we don't want to be making too big a generalizations, but should it be influencing prognosis on those sorts of things?
Potentially. It's so hard to say, I think, because we just don't know enough about it.
Right.
There's not the individual RCTs on women in this category to be able to inform those decisions.
Because I've heard it mentioned in some trial data, but never, it's kind of crops up as a word within a discussion section rather than it being seen as being a primary influencer or even causal factor. And like you've said, they've not necessarily, especially on the large trials, they've not necessarily made an appropriate, you know, the only reason they've gendered the analysis is they've not really considered menopause within that. And so they've not done it by age and by gender. Example.
Yeah, so then it makes it more difficult to actually understand the data, especially when you're talking about women. And if we're starting to, you know, it's great that we're starting to get some evidence and some research around kind of like female athletes and stuff like that, but actually it's generalizable to a small population of women, but actually there's a bigger population that we do need to be a bit more, okay, we need some more information on this, because we're also, you know, postmenopausally we're reducing strength as well. So our muscular strength just naturally decreases as well. You know, we get less motor units. Our muscle fibers change from a type 2 to a type 1. So we can't produce as much force. We can't train in that same way.
Right.
But we can still make a difference if we exercise. You know, it doesn't matter how old you are. Strength training will always improve your strength. So it's never saying that someone's too old to do something. We can always influence those changes and muscularly as well. But again, it's having more time for recovery, because if we haven't got that healing, if it's taking longer, we haven't got that strength to be able to do that, then we're more prone to have injuries, more prone to falls, more prone to fractures. And then the long-term effects of that then.
Well, that's the horrible couple, isn't it? Whereby your predisposition increases, various different things, but then also your ability to overcome said problems is then really challenged too by the same sorts of phenomena. And especially when, as you say, it's not always obvious and overt as to when these things start to play a part. There are various other reasons as to why that might be difficult to put a finger on. And I sort of want to go there now as to how do you feel MSK clinicians particularly, but we could keep it fairly broad if we need to, just regards to healthcare professionals, and thinking, how do you feel it's best to approach those sorts of things in assessments?
I think we have to decrease the taboo around women's health. I think that's where we've got to really start. Yeah. Even when you're talking about kind of like KES patients and asking patients about their bladder and bowel function and sexual, has the ability to orgasm, has that changed? Even those simple questions where we have to ask them for a medical reason, we find very difficult to ask as physios, and I think as kind of like clinicians, kind of like generally, yeah. I think, because they don't come natural to us, because we don't really, I think it comes down to the understanding as to why we're asking them. Because it's a lot easier, like I find it a lot easier to ask those questions because I talk about it every day. Sure. So my tolerance to talking about bladders and bowels and sexual function is quite low. I'll talk about it to anyone really, if they'll give me half an inch, because it's what I do, it's what I discuss on a daily basis. I talk about menstrual health on a daily basis as well. So it's quite easy for me to ask those questions. How old are you? Okay, you're 40, 45. How are your periods? Are they regular? Are you starting to notice any changes? Do you notice, it can be simple as like, do you notice that your symptoms are worse around your period?
Mm-hmm.
And that can be just a nice opening. And then they go, actually, I don't get any periods. Or, yes, actually, there does seem to be some kind of cycle to it, but I'm quite irregular. But definitely when it's, I am due a period, I am aware of it more. More people we're tracking our periods a lot more, I think, because it's more accessible. It's on your Fitbit, it's on your Garmin, it's on your phone. It's, those apps are there. So I think a lot more people are tracking things a little bit more. And they can give you that opening and that kind of just alleyway in just to start discussing it. And you can just say, okay, just because it could potentially be affecting your symptoms. It may not be the primary cause, but it may not be helping you in terms of your recovery. Does that kind of like answer your question?
Absolutely, it does. Nice. That's spot on. I think that the heart of it is just like, if you are someone that's trying to think of a way to be polite, when really I just want to say, look, we need to just grow up and get on with it and be brave on some of it. I was about to sugar my words, but fundamentally, of all the things, considering we've already just listed its importance and its influence and ways in which historically we've made the mistake of not considering these factors as primary, then the least we can do is ask questions or get over a degree of squeamishness, which is bizarre for it to be major. So if it's minor, then let's crack on. I suppose one of the things are there say age related, even within a gender or gendered sort of concerns with regards to inappropriateness of those sorts of things coming in? Does a younger woman asking those questions almost seem like it's making an implication and could be dealt with insensitively? Is that sort of thing that you've faced or heard of?
I think it just comes down to how you ask it. Right. If you come out of the blue and it's the first thing that you ask, then it probably has no context to it. It's about framing the question within the context of what you're trying to find. So if you're kind of like preambling it a little bit with, okay, so you've mentioned a couple of these symptoms, is there any association or have you noticed any association with your periods, with the regularity of your periods, are things changing? And it gives them a bit more opening to ask. In the same way that if you had someone who had suspected CRES, you would be going, okay, you've mentioned this and this with regards to your back pain. Have you noticed bladder or bowel changes, any bladder retention, any fecal incontinence? Mm-hmm. Again, with men, speak to men, have you got any erectile dysfunction? If you are nervous about asking the question, the patient is going to feel nervous about asking it and not really sure why. Whereas if you've got a confidence, and this is definitely something I learned very young as a pelvic health physio, because I was probably about 22, 23. So I was quite young. I was just like, I don't want to be asking people about their sex life. That's really inappropriate. But actually, it has a function. There's a reason why I'm asking it. And my treatment got better once I started asking it, because I would be able to provide them with management a little bit better. So once I got over my reservedness about asking those questions, it helped me in terms of the management of my patients, and it was a lot easier to manage them, and they didn't mind answering the questions because it made sense to them as to why they were doing so. I think a lot of it is sometimes down to our reservedness about asking some of the questions.
Yeah, absolutely. And to, if it's important enough, you've got to find a way. I remember Chris Mercer saying that on a show on Corder Equine years ago. And he just said, like, well, what on earth is the alternative? You've just got to find a way through it. It's sort of a duty as a professional to try and find a way to get over those sorts of things. But in this instance, it's I suppose to give clarity on that extra bit of my question about the specificity of where it might be uncomfortable, it's just you can think, if it wasn't dealt with sensitively, you could imagine, say, a younger woman coming across as if they were implying a more causally relevant piece to a menopausal story that the patient might not have considered and might consider to be somehow uncomfortable. Again, only if it was insensitively approached. And then similarly, you can imagine that it might feel somehow, if dealt with badly, an inappropriate thing for a man to ask.
Yeah, you can have those spectrums. It's probably sometimes where I've just not been in the right frame of mind. I've probably asked the question a bit wrongly, and then I've just gone, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean for that to come across that way.
Right.
This is what I meant. And yeah, there are always difficulties with questions and how they come across and when we should be asking them. But again, it's that importance of it. If we've got a clinical reason as to why we're asking it, then we should be okay to ask it.
Yeah.
And if we explain to why we're asking, it's probably not explaining why we're asking a question, which probably leads to discomfort and sensitivity and not understanding and those mixed messages.
Hmm. That's a good point. I think that's a good point, because I think in your line of work, it still needs to be approached with an appropriate sensitivity, it isn't a surprise to many, I imagine. Whereas in MSK circumstances, especially when you've deemed it appropriate to ask those questions, and good on you, and get stuck into it, really, you need to make sure you do, because of the reason we've described, it's important enough for you to do so. It's still going to be more likely worthwhile for you to clarify that these things do influence XYZ, and therefore I'm asking for those reasons, rather than someone thinking it's so out of left field that would disconcert them and they'd be willing to answer, but then it might colour the entire interaction because it's sort of not, the why hasn't been explained, and so they felt a bit obliged to answer but uncomfortable that they've had to. So I think that's in MSK context, I think it's probably worth that extra little bit of time to make sure it lands well.
Yeah, and it's framing the question, isn't it? And okay, you've mentioned this and this. This could be related to menopause. Have you noticed any changes in your periods? Any other symptoms, that could be associated with it? But it comes down to that subjective and our framing of our questions, which gets better the more we do it, and we're better at it. the more we do.
The classic, there's something onto a clinical case, I guess, the classic thing that you would think of really, or I do at least, with MSK is where you've got someone that's presented with what we now call greater trochanteric pain syndrome, combination now we understand as being a lateral glute tendinopathy plus or minus bursal irritation. Lots of theory as to why that's overrepresented in women with regards to, say, pelvic shape, etc. But then also we now understand it to be overrepresented in menopausal women, perimenopausal women. That's clearly something based on what you've described, really, with regards to sort of tendon response, as well as then ability to rehabilitate, say, the glutes at a rate to try and offload that tendon, etc., and change behaviours. So I bring that up as a means of then thinking, when we're taking a thorough subjective assessment, and also, you know, objective, let's just say assessment in general, and we're thinking of all the factors contributing and affecting these symptoms, and the aging profile, and we've asked all our questions sensitively, that there's something that's likely to be playing a part and contributing to it. How might we differentiate then the menopausal related contributors from the other things, or can we not, and do we need to? I suppose is my question.
I don't really know, is the honest answer, because again, I don't think we know enough about it. I don't think we know. We're not at a stage, I don't think. We're starting to identify that potentially hormones are contributing to these things, but how much and at what point is it, you know, menopause, or is it just the tendinopathy that's playing a part? I think if you're thinking, I'd probably say if they're not responding to normal rehab that you would give them, and they've got other menopausal symptoms, then I'd be asking them to go away, have a read, give them sometimes a bit of a menopause symptom tracker. There's quite a few kind of like online. It's just kind of like a bit of a tick box, like how often have you experienced X, Y, and Z. And if that's then, you know, if they're ticking quite a few boxes, then it's probably worthwhile them going to have the chat with their GP about, okay, what can we do to help you? As opposed to kind of like trying, you know, because it could be that they do just need that extra, you know, hormonal support, which will help them recover, because then, you know, potentially they've got that ability where, you know, in terms of healing, that healing is going to be better, that inflammation is going to be better controlled. So if it's not responding to normal, then do we need to consider? But again, I was just reading kind of like the other day, there's just not enough research out there to say that hormonal HRT basically is, or having a tendinopathy is enough to warrant having HRT, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think
again, we just don't know enough.
Well, on that, I think, because as I'm asking the question, and also when I've been thinking about many clinical cases of which fit this profile, two things you don't want to happen. One is you don't want to then go through what is often slow stream rehab, trying to work up various different, and you're going steady because of the reasons we've talked about, and you're recognizing and talking through all these factors. They're engaging really well, but it's sore. You're asking them to do some quite inconvenient things, like not crossing your legs and don't sleep on that side, and you're getting them to load it up often at a really slow pace. What you don't want to happen, and it's happened to me a couple of times, and I've tried to learn this lesson and kick myself, but you know, they then thank you for said 6 months worth of really slow stream and somewhat boring rehab, Jack, but I've gone on to HRT, I'm doing loads better, I wish I'd have done that sooner. And I you know, I can't help but kick myself as to the fact that I was being ignorant to how clearly in this instance you know, that those were clearly colouring the picture more than I was thinking. I mean, there's all sorts of things that I can help myself sleep at night, knowing that it could well have been just the timing's helped, and that all the strength work is going to have helped to some degree. So I'm not beating myself up massively, but there's something to be said for the fact, especially in one instance, it was a family member, right? So you're just in a thing that it's like, if I'd have had the foresight to maybe make that suggestion sooner, then maybe you'd have had less discomfort as you have for the last months. That's one thing. And then the other side is, you don't want to then be cavalier on that, and someone presents with greater trochanteric pain syndrome, and you send them straight for it, because it's not without its risks, and the GPs aren't going to be best pleased with you. And so, you know, that's the sort of funny line that we're trying to toe.
Yeah, and I think it's difficult. It's just it's a balance, isn't it? And it's so hard to, like you said, it's so hard to know where that line is, and you know, what point is too soon. But I think it just comes down to that bigger picture, kind of like of the symptoms as well, you know, because the majority of women have more than one symptom of menopause.
Right.
It's very, you know, it's very unusual that they'd only have one. But I'm sure there are people out there, you know, if you're thinking about that broad spectrum of the 34 odd kind of like symptoms of menopause. But like joint pain is like the predominant symptom, about 21% of that. So that's quite a significant amount. And right. When they've looked at studies, and I think where they've taken people have been on HRT and then they've taken that away for other reasons, actually the joint pain has increased. So it does have its place. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, I don't think it's in a position to be prescribed purely for joint pain.
Yeah, that'd be a big, it would be a big step, wouldn't it? Yeah.
I think it's just, we just don't know enough. Mm. And which is a real shame, because we're in 2021 and this is something that happens to 50% of the population and we're only just starting to talk about it.
Yeah, it's slightly adjacent, but I mean, there's a cracking podcast on the At Your Cervix podcast with Emma Gronje, and they had Izzy Moore on, and Izzy did a session at Therapy Live Pelvic Health, of which I just happened to be the moderator for, and we're talking about female-specific research participants and the like, and trying to be where it is appropriate and necessary to be female-centric with regards to, you know, sex-based differences within it, and how we can bring that data to bear so it can inform decisions like we're talking about. Because the consequences of that information and that evidence would really help in those sorts of clinical scenarios. And I'm not describing niche cases, am I? Like, that happens so much. And, you know, there's so many other examples we could bring. And we need that to inform it. Otherwise, it is just, you know, it's reasoning-based guesswork, and it's better than not thinking about it. But it is, you know, it shouldn't be difficult, and it shouldn't have taken as long as it has for us to be thoughtful in that direction. So, you know, I totally agree, and encourage everyone to have a listen in that direction as well, because it's like there's some great stuff coming out of there, so especially from Izzy Moore. So what are the, say, preventive measures, say, or are there interventions, exercise or otherwise, that you would want to do if you were starting to go through and be perimenopausal, early onset, whatever it might be in terms of timing? What is it that that we should be, say, encouraging, or would women be wanting to go through?
The two key things, which I think is just general for everyone, I think, is diet and exercise. Right. You know, good healthy diet, reducing constipation, because if you're quite constipated, then you can harbour hormones for a little bit longer and they get reabsorbed into the system. Yeah, exercise, strength training, that risk of, you know, osteoporosis, you know, actually really quite high. One in two women get osteoporosis. Wow. That's a high number postmenopausally, and you can make changes to that. You can potentially prevent that quite a bit by good diet, so making sure you're getting calcium in your diet. But actually, I think they've looked at some studies where actually more looked at countries, I think, who have high milk intake, and actually their risk of fractures aren't any different. But definitely strength training is very much up there, you know, and impact exercises. And you can improve your strength at no matter what age. I think they've done a couple of trials where they've got 60 to 80 year olds doing deadlifts, jumping chin ups, and then dropping back down onto the floor. And they've been fine. They haven't fallen. They haven't fractured. They've gotten better. They've gotten stronger. Their balance is better. And then just aerobic exercise as well, because that's good for our health. That's good for our endorphins. That's good for regulating stress, which our stress during perimenopause with all these changes going on as well, you know, our cortisol levels are probably up all over the place, which then makes it harder to manage everything else as well, which will then help with the weight gain. And then like a good diet. And yeah, comes back to that good diet thing. So I think it's just that foundations. I think we've lost our way a little bit as a nation, and we don't realize the importance of what we can do ourselves in terms of our training, our healthy eating and our exercise. And those things are really important.
And do we have evidence that suggests then if we go about things in a preventative manner to better, you know, it's easier said than done, of course, but, you know, go about things with positive diet and exercise related changes and for those to be baked in as habits into our 20s, 30s, 40s, does that delay the menopause? Does it make it a softer landing when it occurs? Do we have any evidence for that?
I don't think there's any particular evidence for that. I think it can help a majority of women, but some women do need that HRT. They do need that estrogen if they're safe and they've got no contraindications to it. But that, alongside diet and exercise, almost boosts everything.
Sure.
I think there's evidence, like, coming back to incontinence because it's what I know, pelvic floor exercises and vaginal estrogens have about the same effect when used separately, but join them together and the effect's fantastic. So you kind of have to take that bit of a principle to it as well, because if your estrogens, and I think it's more to do with the steep decline, you'll probably end up at the same point in terms of age related changes. So your end point's the same, but it's how fast you get there. If that decline is slower and a bit more regulated, then your body's got time to adapt to those changes in terms of decreasing estrogen. Whereas if you go through menopause and all of a sudden you stop, then I think that's where they, from my understanding of what I've read, that's what they're looking into as to why why people are a bit more symptomatic and problematic in terms of other kind of like complications and stuff going on.
Yeah. I suppose one of the things as well is the health and state of your body as you enter that disruptive phase is then what is the baseline. It's your starting off point, isn't it? And so reason enough, if you happen to be entering that with relative osteopenia, even, you know, and independent of what were menopausal factors, just from you know, low impact exercise, lack of impact exercise, etc., or the diet related changes and stuff, then you are naturally going to be predisposed to have more of those challenges now that you've got even more to handle and deal with. So that's some motivation as well. And without that being known, you know, it's just so gutting how inevitable a lot of suffering may be. And so raising the awareness of it, as we've talked about, is key. But what I wanted to ask then, why do you think it is that really there has been such a significant lag? And it does seem that we can't help but throw our hands up and think, well, how ridiculous is it that we would still be in the dark on some of these pivotal questions?
This really brings up feminist in me, and I never thought I would be this. And I think I listened to...
Sock it to me.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, and I listened to Gráinne and Emma's podcast with Michelle Lyons, which kind of like briefly, it was all about hormones and stuff like that. And I think it's because it doesn't happen to a man.
Right.
If it were to happen, you know, I think Michelle said that the erectile dysfunction affects 19% of men. Right. Yet there's an extortionate amount more evidence and RCTs around that than there is to do with female dysfunction.
Right.
So that, and I genuinely do think, and whether it's because we've been told to put up with it, it's fine. You just, you know, it's just something that you put up with. It's fine. You know, don't worry about it. You have periods. It's something that happens on a monthly basis. Just get on with it. We deal with chronic, you know, periods is a chronic condition. You know, it starts at the age of, you know, 10, 9, right. 12, whatever, for, you know, and it goes through with you for a lifetime. I think there is an element of that going through it to a degree, unfortunately.
But there's some cracking like skits and sketches been done where it's slightly different, but if men breastfed, then think of the facilities at the workplace and stuff like that. Like there's exactly, like some really good like sketches been done where you could just imagine, you know, be twice the size of the boardroom would be the milking room, wouldn't it? But it doesn't shift over. I think one of the things then, you know, existential question, certainly we'd struggle for time on this podcast, but maybe a future conversation, not necessarily with me, by the way, I'm sure there's people have had a good chat about this, is then the balance between is it that it's not, you know, how much is supply and demand, right? How much has it been raised and ignored by a systemically biased society and medical establishment? And how much is it that because it's been considered and deemed by women to be, unfortunately, yet another inconvenient bodily function, that it hasn't made the appropriate adjustment to, you know, what, as you describe, what women ask, need and ask of their bodies that's different to yesteryear.
Yeah. I think it's probably definitely a combination of the two things. I think we're becoming a bit more vocal now. I mean, there's a great movement. I think Davina McCall's documentary on menopause has opened up kind of like a massive discussion that needed to be had. But, and now there are discussions within Parliament to have this, you know, menopause, making menopause actually matter. But it is really important, because there's a vast majority of the workforce that are female and over 50. So it's going to affect them, you know, considerably. So it's going to have an effect on the economy. It's going to, you know, these are bigger picture kind of like discussions that need to be had.
Annoying thing though, that'll make them listen. Like if you start thinking about, oh, it's going to affect your bottom line, they're suddenly like, oh, right, well, let's have a parliamentary debate about it. And so whilst they're not, anything that does get that talk happening, then great. But it's just such a weird shame, thing. That, you know, the pain, suffering, challenge, the especially the uncertainty that's occurred, where and the self blame that maybe I should be handling this better type stuff. It's like that's exactly the sort of thing you'd hope would motivate better policy, right? Yeah. But of course, no, it has to trickle to economics.
Yeah.
I want to admit one thing as well, though, where I'll say that I find your work's helped me in this direction massively, and that Pelvic Health Therapy Live show did in general, really, for us to sort of recognise that these things are important enough for me to get over any levels of squeamishness. Now, some of the low-grade stuff is just it seldom bothered me. Right? I'm not backwards in coming forwards. I talk on the internet. I'm kind of over it. But on menopausal-related factors, as well as their menstrual factors generally, is that there's a contention there that you kind of feel like, I'm going to, in case I look like I'm at risk of inferring and implying hormonal-related factors on women that might be influencing their physiology and, dare you say, their behaviour, then you think, well, in case someone might think I'm just dismissing someone as hysterical or kind of harking back to, oh, that's cause of that, or are you on? You know, all these different sort of culture tropes that you'd be mortified, you'd hope, as any sane person would be mortified at coming across that way anyway. But in a medical and professional setting, it's like, I'm going to opt out of that potentially being how it's coming across or heard. Yeah. I'm going to therefore just opt out completely. And I don't necessarily now mean on the specific questions of bringing that to bear in an assessment. Now I'm talking about suggesting that these things would have a societal impact and affect the way in which men and women might interact in various different circumstances and the way in which women live their lives. So I just wanted to throw that out there and admit that myself.
But yeah, and I think it is going to kind of like influence things to a degree, but if you take chronic pain for an example, we're changing the conversation about chronic pain. We're moving away from, you know, or hopefully moving away from that thing where people are, or it's implied that chronic pain is in your head, and we're becoming a lot better at explaining that actually it's not in your head, it's the way that your body is processing stuff. So maybe we just need to have that same kind of like analogy and that thought process around kind of like our mental health. We're not saying that it's, you know, it's your hormones, but it is your hormones type of thing. You know, it's just having that kind of like understanding of, okay, we know that there's fluctuations, we know that these things are kind of like going on and they can influence these things kind of like negatively. Is this something that you have ever considered or discussed or been aware of, to then open up that conversation kind of like a little bit more?
Yeah, of course. No, it makes sense. And I think what is, because your chronic pain analogy is great, I suppose the history is in chronic pain that you would be mind-body dualist and you would be implying that therefore that this is something that we can't find organic cause for, and therefore this is something that's a psychological phenomena or at best a neurological phenomena that's sort of somewhat separate. And then the modern way would be for us to be more mature and holistic and integrative of those things. I suppose with the analogy I'm trying to carry a bit with the conversations about menstruation and menopause, more generally, is that you're then speaking to something that the cultural zeitgeist, to some degree, is then to imply that there is no real relevant difference between men and women on a biological and physiological level in many ways. And that implication means that then to talk about it is then to point fingers at causes of differences that then, you know, is culturally something that's quite the hot topic.
And it's difficult. I think it is just difficult. I think we're going through such a transition, I'd probably say, culturally, I think, kind of like at the moment. But I think we've got to be open to having those discussions around hormones and menstruation and how it potentially kind of like affects everything. Because if we don't, then are we doing our best by our patients?
No.
Are we doing our best by ourselves?
Mm.
I think it is really, it's difficult. There's lots of conversations going on around all these things, kind of like, I think, kind of like at the moment, which does make it a bit more, how do we phrase it?
You got, maybe we're making us all a bit more thoughtful about our language. Your work in this area, as I said, on this podcast and beyond, has really helped to influence the fact that this is an important part of what we need to be factoring in and allowing to influence our reasoning. And in normal terms, it just feels like that is likely to then be the thin end of the wedge, and then more and more people are going to be aware of it, and therefore it's going to be factored. In fact, the only thing that gives me pause, and I want to see if it does you, is that because of what I've just described, is that one of the reasons why I don't think, I'm mixing my metaphors now, I said thin end of the wedge, I think I'd rather say it should light the touch paper, it should then fuel a further conversation. So one of the reasons I worry it might not, and I wonder if you do too, is because of the fact that it is seen as being sort of biologically essentialist, and that you're then making an implication of something that, and you've made a case as to why it's so important, but it's something that isn't necessarily, say, fashionable enough to carry, or people might just opt out of that conversation. Is that something you're concerned about?
No, I think the menopause talk is going to grow. I've got a feeling we're going to be in a better position. I really hope, kind of like 10 years, it's going to be a very different conversation that we'd be having, that is a lot more open. You know, we do talk about kind of like, even in talking about pelvic health, we're talking about that a bit more. You know, women postnatally are talking, but, you know, it's still taboo. It's still not as open as what it should be. But we're definitely opening up that conversation a lot more. I'm getting a lot more, just from my own clinical kind of like experience, I'm getting a lot more younger women going, actually, I don't want to put up with this anymore, or this has just started, I want to get something done about it now before it gets any worse, as opposed to like this real gap of kind of like your postmenopausal, I've had this for donkey's years, finally decided, and then they sent me to you and it's made a big difference. And then like this younger spectrum of I've just started to notice that it's starting to happen, I'm starting to get a bit of incontinence, I'm starting to not be as in control.
Right.
And they're wanting to get something done about it. So I think, you know, and, you know, if you're looking at the Twitter, especially around all the Davina stuff and around menopause, that conversation is happening a lot more. People are a lot more, they're happier to go forth and go to the GP now. Whereas I think with the bad press around HRT, that's put a real big dampener on everything for about 20 years, and negatively so for women. That actually we're now starting to emerge from that, we're getting a change in perspective. There's a lot more people going, actually, yes, this is okay, this is what you need. You know, if we had low thyroid, we wouldn't go, oh no, I'm not going to take my thyroxine and my levothyroxine, I'm going to take the hormone that I want. If I got low estrogen, I should be able to get my estrogen.
Yeah, absolutely. Is then, because we're talking about sort of education on a very public level, but also interprofessionally, as we're actually creating some now, is obviously one of the key strategies. Just how far do you think that should reach? So we know that the classic sort of PSHE, it's, you know, sex education and that sort of thing, whereby you'd learn a bit about say puberty and things, is that an appropriate place to then also then throw that forward some? Is it sort of thing that should be more curricular biology lessons? Where do you see it best being best placed?
I definitely think that PSE level, you know, right. in school, actually, this is what's going to happen to you. So even if you've got a bit of awareness of, okay, potentially, you know, even if that word is thrown out there, okay, it's breaking, okay, this is going to happen, because we get taught about our periods, and then that's pretty much about it. We get taught a little bit about pregnancy and what happens, but very little about actually the process in terms of hormonally and kind of actually the process of it. Why shouldn't we be taught about menopause?
Yeah.
And the understanding, and this is okay, this is the lifespan. So, you know, for a woman, you start your periods, then, you know, you go through, and then it will come to an end, because you've only got a certain amount of eggs there. You know, once your eggs are gone, they're gone.
Yeah.
You know, so we should know the whole life cycle, as opposed to just knowing like the beginning. And the earlier we know about it, again, I'm bringing it back to incontinence, because it's what we know. The more we kind of raise that awareness that incontinence is common but not normal, the more we get people through, and we more realize that actually this isn't, you know, oh, I'm not, don't have to put up with it. So the more
there's stuff we can do about it. That's the thing.
Yeah, exactly.
It'd be worthwhile as a means of trying to stop people. So say there wasn't any positive intervention that could be done. So let's go incontinence. Destigmatize it, and also then helping people to recognize a lack of fault that when they're feeling guilty for it, and to make sure we sort of socialize ourselves to be more sensitive to those sorts of things, even if we didn't have positive interventions. But much like incontinence, when we've got such positive interventions, it's like you only have to really talk about it for a while to realize that it's just a no-brainer for it to be something that we talk about, and then we fund and we support and we educate people around, because it's like, you know, there's no trade-off almost. Like, where is the downside?
Yeah, there is no downside to knowing more about your body. Well, you know, where is the downside about knowing more about your body? Yeah. And especially if it's going to come through to, it's going to happen. Every woman, everyone with a uterus, everyone with ovaries is going to go through the menopause. Mm. How that menopause is going to be is going to be different. It's not going to be the same for me as it's going to be for kind of like Doris two doors down the road. No. You know, it's not going to be the same, but we need to know about it. We need to know what we can do to make it easier. So being active, having a good diet, you know, all the things we know, but the importance of strength training to help us with our bone density, to reduce our risk of fractures. You know, if we were just talking about that bit, okay, strength training is really, really important, because A, it maintains your muscle mass, it helps with your bone density, reduces your risk of osteoporosis, can actually change your bone density and improve it if you do strength training and you do impact training, and make you reduce that risk of falls, which means you're not going to end up in hospital, which means then you're going to need less care, which means you're going to manage really well. Yeah. And you're going to have a long, fulfilling life, you know, or anything else kind of like going on. But, you know, just in that small aspect of things, you know, up until, you know, hopefully that you're 80, you know, 83 or the average age or beyond.
Mm. I think as well, it's a really interesting thing where I know that throwing back to, you know, PSE lessons at school and stuff, it's like, the amount of times, partly because they were just sort of knew they were going to need to do something that the teachers or whoever it might have been felt was cringe. I think that probably I learned from putting condoms on carrots and dildos that happened to have a base on them and the giggles that then, you know, dissipated within a few minutes, is that instead to understand that this is a puberty, and this is how males and females might differ from that, but then also why that addendum and, you know, bit towards then this is where in the circumstance of women, and there's, you know, there's then things you could learn at the end of it's different, but the lifespan, it wouldn't need to fail to mention a difference in lifespan factors for men, but generally why not? And also the the thing that I would have benefited for greatly with regards to the important women in my life of all ages. You know, it's like what a ridiculous thing that wouldn't be a useful thing to understand, and also how positively that would contribute to an understanding population at large, and to stop a silly culture war where they try to pitch genders against each other when we're trying to get better care for everyone and to naturally live together as sisters, brothers, men, wife, fathers, daughters, that sort of stuff. It's like, why was having a better understanding? Because you mentioned, what is the downside of understanding more about your body? Like, well, yeah, I'd extend that as well to what is understanding more about each other and just having that sensitivity and sympathies where appropriate to what we're all going through. Right. Yeah. And it just seems fascinating that it just seems a penalty kick. Like, why are we not taking it? Although football analogies are very painful for me right now.
I'm so sorry for your loss.
So thank you so much for a great conversation. As I was really looking forward to this, but I learned a lot from your public talks, as well as then now being able to put some of the more nitty-gritty questions to you. Wondered where everyone else can find more about you and get in touch with you, as well as then if you have any signposts to any other information about this subject.
Most of my clinical stuff I do kind of like on Twitter, so I don't even know my handle, regriff87 or re87griff, something along those lines.
Oh, people, if you want it enough, you're going to guess it right.
You usually find me at it. You know, there's probably some kind of like therapy live podcast or physio matters thing with kind of like that I've retweeted somewhere kind of like along the line, but I can never remember it, and I just use that.
We'll shoehorn it into the show notes. You'll be surprised, a lot of people don't know their handle, so it's fun.
But in terms of good resources for menopause, my menopausal doctor, so Dr. Louise Newsome, fantastic, absolutely fantastic website with lots of patient-friendly information to go on there. And then if you're looking more kind of like around the diet and that kind of like side of things, then Positive Pause is another really good resource. If you're looking for like posters and information packs to put up on your kind of like clinic walls and stuff like that, just kind of like, okay, making people aware so it's just there, because I've had a few patients who've just seen posters and asked me a little bit more about it, so that can be a good place to go. Positivity 2, I think they're called, on Twitter. They're really good as well. All of them have Twitter handles as well, which is fantastic. But sweet. British Menopause Society as well, and they've got a good resource as well from a clinical perspective. But yeah, it's quite a bit of information on there.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for this, and also for being a real leading light on getting this stuff known. As we've talked about much in this podcast, it's all about getting people educated, but someone's got to do the doing, and you've been there. You've stepped up on very, we've put you into some funny spots and asked you to apply it to different contexts, and you know, you've pitched it so brilliantly. So I'm glad we've been able to do this. It feels like this is the third of a hat trick of pieces of content with us. We'll leave you alone for a bit, I promise.
It makes my brain work.
Good. I'm glad. Well, fine.
Oh, no, I shouldn't have said that. Now
you've said that.
It's like, damn.
Yeah, you shouldn't have said that to me. But no, I really do appreciate it. And I'm not surprised that it's gone down a storm. You know, long may that continue, as no doubt. And we're all hopeful that more data comes forward, more understanding, more anecdotes, more case studies that we can apply this to, so that we can then make true progress in this area and beyond, because it really does influence far more than people realise. And so thanks for all your work, and we'll hopefully just continue to provide a megaphone for it for whenever you need.
Cheers, thank you.
And there we have it, session 93. Many thanks to Rhiannon, of course, as ever, for her brilliant work. And I'm so glad to have had that chat with her. It definitely got me thinking, and I know it has many of you on this subject. She's been a brilliant communicator of these ideas, and I hope you've enjoyed that as much as we have. Then please do check out rehabmypatient.com and sign up at /therapylive or /physiomatters for your 3-month free trial via us, and you will not be disappointed. Really excited for the episodes we've got coming up as we build for that 100th episode. I'm really looking forward to that. And also, please do check out therapy-live.co.uk/tickets for Therapy Live Business on the 18th of September. It's absolutely stacked program, three streams of education about enhancing and improving your therapy business, regardless of what phase you're in. So we've got three streams: foundations, progression, and innovation. And so there's something for everyone across various different topics. So please do join us for that. But leaves me the great pleasure of signing out with the final point of you've been listening to the Physio Matters podcast, discussing physio matters because physio matters. Bye for now.